You might remember that yesterday I told you that I was going through the appearance of the five Buddhas in the Bardo of Reality in the wrong order, not the order given in the Bardo Tadol. And today we can go to the first day and the first Buddha to appear in the Bardo, the first form that manifests after one has fallen away from the clear light of undiluted reality that shines forth at the moment of death. After swooning away from that, one comes to, and the whole of space is just one vast, deep blue light. And from the centre of that, appearing from the central Buddha field called Pervasive Seminal Point, the transcendent Lord Vairochana, the Illuminator, appears. And he's dazzling white in colour, seated on a splendid throne of lions. He's holding an 8-spoked golden wheel of the Dharma, Dharma Chakra, and he's embracing his consort, the Lady of the Realm of Space. And from the heart of this brilliant white Buddha, a rich, bright, dazzling blue light comes forth, emanates, symbolizing the Dharma Dhatu Jnana, the wisdom of reality's expanse, the wisdom of all-pervading reality. And this light stretches towards your heart, but it's so brilliant that you can't bear it, you can't take it in. And at the same time as this light of wisdom shines, a dull white light shines towards your heart. And the dull light is comforting and inviting, seductive. It's the dull white light of the realm of the gods. And under the sway of your habit of deep delusion, under the sway of the poison of deep delusion, you go towards the dull white light. And once again, the Lama, reading from the text of the Bardo Tadol, urges you not to go to the dull white light, but respond instead to the brilliant, dazzling blue light. If you follow the blue light, you're enlightened in Vairochana's realm. If you follow the dull white light, you're reborn in the realm of the gods. You're reborn in the wheel of life. You'll be subject to suffering. You'll be in a realm of deep delusion. So, the realm of the gods. Well, the realm of the gods, of course, the Devaloka, is a happy heavenly realm. It's actually rather a large realm. We've got a wheel of life in the vestibule out here. If you were to really draw that section of the realm of the gods properly, it'd be a much bigger section proportionately to the rest of the wheel. It would need to kind of go up like that. It's a very large realm. Apparently, according to the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddhist vision of things, in the universe there are far more happy and blissful and heavenly beings proportionately than any other beings. It's an interesting thought, very hopeful in a way. And Lama Govinda makes this point that there's greater potentiality for happiness in the universe than unhappiness. And the God realm, in fact, extends over three planes of existence. This is another traditional Buddhist analysis. There's kind of three strata to existence. There's the Karmaloka, the world of sense experience that we're very familiar with. And there's the Rupaloka, which is the realm or the world of subtle form. And then there's the Arupaloka, usually translated as the formless world, but you could say it's the world of extremely subtle form. And the God realm covers those three stratas. So you've got sort of lower gods who occupy more sort of subtle, more subtle sense plane than ourselves. You've got gods who occupy a kind of world of pure, subtle, archetypal form. And then you've got gods right at the sort of pinnacle of existence, if you like, who are so subtle, they're virtually formless. They're just beings of light. And if you look through Buddhist literature, you get very detailed explanations of these god realms. And they all have wonderful names, which are very, very suggestive. But they're all mundane in the sense that they're all part of conditioned existence. They're all part of the wheel of life. Even the highest gods at the pinnacle of things, they're not enlightened. They're part of the wheel of life. None of these realms represent a permanent attainment, even though you might be in them from, you know, if you like, our point of view, for what seems like an eternity. They actually do not last forever. And the traditional view is that beings are reborn in these realms because of skillful action. If you live a skillful life, an ethical life, a moral life, a generous life, a truthful life, you'll be reborn in higher, happy realms. You'll accumulate merit and you'll be reborn as a god. Nice. It's also said that the god realms are the sort of objective correlative of higher meditation states, of dhyanas. When you dwell in dhyana, if you, in meditation, enter a dhyana, a higher state of consciousness, you are, at that time, a deva. You are a god. And if you are very familiar with dhyanas in a future life, you will become a god. You'll be reborn in that realm. You might even be reborn into the Arupa Loka. You'll become a formless god. And the formless gods represent the furthest limit of mundane existence, as far as you can go, as it were, this side of enlightenment. Somebody once said, here, the distinction between self and other, subject and object, is extraordinarily fine. But it hasn't been seen through, so you can fall away, you can fall back. All of the god realms are deeply pleasurable. The higher you go in them, the deeper, the subtler, the pleasure, the bliss. And depictions in Buddhist art of the gods are of a very beautiful realm. Beautiful beings, androgynous beings. In the god realms, there's no sexual distinctions. There's no distinction between man and woman. You've got these angelic, I suppose, beings, and they're often depicted playing music, listening to music, dancing, wearing silks and ornaments and garlands, residing in beautiful heavenly mansions in bodies of light. So, of course, we all think we'd like to go there. We'd like to be reborn in the world of the gods. And why not? And why not? Certainly, if you're having a particularly tough life, it's not a bad orientation, really, is it? And actually, towards the end of the Bardo Tadol, if it's becoming clear that you're going to be reborn, if you've missed the chance for enlightenment, the Lama, in reading the book, urges you to aim for birth in the human realm or the god realm. This is what he says. Okay, you know, it's been tough. You haven't kind of made enlightenment, but for goodness sake, get in one of those, because the other states are so miserable and so unhappy. I really like that. Again, the pragmatism of Buddhist tradition. But, even so, the god realm is a state of suffering. And I'll say what kind of suffering befalls the gods in a moment. But first of all, I want to look at this phrase, deep delusion. The habit of deep delusion. The poison of deep delusion, which the dull light of the gods represents. I want to look at deep delusion as a way of closing down bardo, closing down the space. We've seen a similar term used in relation to the animals. You close down the bardo through, in the animal realm, through ignorance, through the green light, responding to the green light of ignorance. That leads to the animal realm. So what's the difference between the dull white light of deep delusion emanating from the god realm and the dull green light of ignorance leading to the animal realm? Well, it's in a way a much more subtle, a much more seductive way of, if you like, of dealing with the openness, of the spaciousness of bardo. Here one finds pleasure in the space. One enjoys the opening, the openness. One therefore gets kind of attached to the openness. And when you get attached to the openness, the reality that could arise within that space, well, you don't see it. It can happen sometimes in meditation. We can feel ourselves opening up. We can feel ourselves entering into dhyana. And it's very, very pleasurable. It's so lovely when that happens. And what can happen is, what we can start to do, of course, is that we can start to think, this is it. I've arrived. I know. And if your meditations go on like this for some time, and, you know, if life is very smooth outside of those meditations, you can even start thinking that, maybe I've gained some kind of insight, some kind of enlightenment. Maybe even start to think that you've sort of dissolved into the luminosity, that you're kind of in touch with your Buddha nature, that you're a Buddha already and you always have been and always will be. There's a feeling of problem solved and dealt with. Life looks very rosy, very good. And maybe it is for some time. But one has not actually recognized the luminosity. One hasn't actually recognized the reality. One hasn't actually dissolved a separate sense of self. Not really. You haven't seen through it. You've just relaxed the tension for a while. And it can happen in time that the old conditioning forces start to reassert themselves and one can fall away from the path altogether. I've seen it, you know, many times over the years in the FWBO at centres and retreat centres and so on. You get people coming along in a bit of a state, untogether, and unhappy. They meditate for a bit. They put it all back together. They seem to be very inspired by the Dharma. They kind of sort themselves out on a level, and then they just give it all up. It's like they've been kind of put together again, so they can just go back and try it again, try the world again. And they leave the path, they leave the Dharma. They just get into other interests. They might not necessarily get into a very painful state. Now, I'm not saying they're doomed, you know, if they do that. But they just sort of, they don't go on more deeply. So becoming a god, living in heaven, entering dhyana, is only part of the path. It's not the whole story. It's a step on the way. And it's great that one gains pleasure from spiritual practice. It's marvellous. It's important that one, you know, has these breakthroughs, these moments. But there is never an end. And one must never think that one has reached an end, that one has arrived. Virochana's wisdom is the Dharma Dhatu Jnana, the wisdom of reality's expanse. And it's deep blue, like the vastness of space. It's all-pervading. Trungpa Rinpoche calls this Dharma Dhatu Jnana panoramic awareness. Panoramic awareness, which is very suggestive, I think. The deep delusion of the God realm is taking hold of, identifying with, just a partial expansion. Just a little bit of spaciousness. Just a little bit of bliss. But it's actually not connecting with all of reality. Perhaps this especially happens when we have those deeply pleasurable meditations, or when we have those wonderfully pleasurable aesthetic moments. We can start overgeneralizing from that bit of experience. Buddhist life is about engaging with reality everywhere. That's why it's very, very challenging. Not just when you meditate, but when you're washing up, when you're working with people, when you're relating to people that you don't like, difficult people. Buddhist life is about the reality that's in the dirt and the grime as much as in the bliss of meditation. Good meditators can be just that. Good on the cushion, but awkward elsewhere. So they avoid elsewhere. They avoid other things. The really good meditators, the great meditators, are in touch with space. They're in touch with reality's expanse. in all things. You often find this in some of the stories of the Mahasiddhas, the tantric masters. You get a teacher with a really hot meditator who's, you know, kind of a bit addicted to the bliss of meditation, and he's just told to go and, you know, to go, you know, to the outcast part of town and find a teacher there in the muck and the grime. So the deep delusion of the God realms is generalizing about reality, about yourself, on the basis of your deep but partial, one-sided meditative or aesthetic experience. In the very first sutta of the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon, the Brahmajala Sutta, the great all-embracing net, the Buddha reveals all the philosophies of his day, all the views of his day, all the imprisoning views of his day. And most of these views come out of the experiences of people who've attained higher heavenly states of being. And he shows that there's been a kind of overgeneralization based on these experiences, exalted though they are. They're only partial, they're illegitimate overgeneralizations based on a somewhat expanded consciousness. There are other ways of looking at the realm of the gods. There are lower gods, like I said, you know, the more on the level of sort of a sort of sense level. And we could just see the gods as a state of continuous happiness and success, maybe even of continuous aesthetic experience. Now, one of the programs I love to listen to on the radio is Saturday morning Radio 3 show. Forget what it's called, but it goes from 9 until 1 o'clock. And you have these guys talking about music, and they just sound like gods. They're so fantastic, the way they talk about these classical composers. Building a library. It's a fantastic program where you'll get all these versions of, you know, a Bach, you know, organ toccata or something like that. And these people just can talk about them with such, not just knowledge, but with real aesthetic pleasure and refinement. God, amazing. Anyway, so maybe even it's continuous aesthetic experience, the realm of the gods. We occupy this happy, easygoing, pleasurable world, or one of great refinement. And you kind of meet people like that sometimes, don't you? Just lovely, beautiful people, and they're good people, you know, they're good looking, they've got lots of friends, and everything seems to kind of come to them. And it's lovely to see, because they are like gods, you know, they've got, you know, beautiful friends, you know, and perhaps you see it more in youth, don't you? You see it in youth very often. Life is good, it's all happening, everything's ahead of them. The fruits of the wish fulfilling tree just seem to drop into their hands, and on they go. They've got talent, charm, looks, culture, intelligence. Somewhere I missed out. you know, it's as if they haven't had to kind of work for very much. I remember, you know, George Best, who the footballer I mentioned the other day. There's a lot of programs about him, and some of the early footage of him. I mean, I loved George Best when I was a kid as well. I mean, I absolutely adored him, and he looked like a god. Yeah, really good looking, beautiful, handsome, fantastic footballer, just so graceful. And then you'd have shots of him, you know, pouring champagne into a kind of, you know, all these champagne glasses, great clothes, beautiful women. God. And of course, it doesn't actually last. The gods suffer very badly, actually. Apparently, one of the great tragedies in the universe, in existence, is the death of a god. And you get descriptions of it in Buddhist literature. It's a kind of slow fading. First of all, their luster fades. You know, gods have this wonderful luster. Their light starts to go out. It all starts to recede. Their complexion goes. Their garlands start to fade and wither. And they begin to smell. Their perfume stops. And they begin to pong. And their god friends leave them. They just don't come around anymore. You're not cool anymore. And the God can feel very lonely as he starts to fade. And then he sees where he's going, what his next birth will be. And compared with what he's experienced, it really is a bad place. So it's one of those very poignant passages in Buddhist literature, the death of a god. And I'm sure you can relate to this either from your own experience or from maybe observing friends of yours. No matter how pleasurable, how blissful the god realm is, it comes to an end. It's impermanent, like everything else. So the danger in the god realm is the deep delusion of not knowing impermanence and change and ending and death. The pleasure, the satisfaction, the bliss is so thoroughgoing, so complete, how could it end? How could it end? So in the God realm one suffers from the deep delusion of complacence. In the realm of the gods, great compassion manifests as the white Buddha Indra Chakra, Indra the king of the gods. And he's holding a veena. The veena is an ancient, very ancient Indian stringed instrument. It's still used in South India, like a sort of lute. It's a bit different from the sitar. It doesn't have a drone string. It has a wonderful, clear sound, beautiful, clear sound. If you hear a really good veena player, it's a wonderful sound. So in the Buddha, the Buddha in the realm of the gods plays beautiful music, plays beautiful ragas. And of course, the gods love music. So when this beautiful musician arrives playing this wonderful sound, they listen, they want to hear it, they're completely wrapped and drawn in to this lovely sound. And as they listen, they find themselves being deeply stirred and deeply moved, because what they find is that in all that beautiful sound, they're becoming aware of ending, of impermanence and death. They're becoming aware of the sufferings in the world. In the realm of the gods, the Buddha doesn't give the gods a lecture, a sermon. They wouldn't hear that. They wouldn't be interested. He enters their world of aesthetic pleasure and refinement and beauty and plays beautifully the tune of impermanence, the tune of reality. He plays things as they are. So when we're in that godlike state, the happiness that comes from meditation or from refinement or from aesthetic experience, whatever pleasure it may be, tune into the impermanence of things. Remind yourself of the impermanence of things. Remind yourself of change. Remind yourself of suffering. Remind yourself of the sufferings of others. Let that truth in. When things go well, when we're very happy, when everything's very beautiful, remind yourself of impermanence. Stay aware. Don't get intoxicated, taken over by the whole scene. Sometimes we can speak of the God realm, the godlike realm, in a highly, you know, deprecating sort of way, that it's somehow bad to be a god. That happiness generated by spiritual practice or aesthetic experience is somehow suspect. You know, it's almost become, you don't hear it so much these days. If it comes up sometimes, you have somebody coming to a class or a retreat and say, bit of a deva, bit of a god, you know, and it's slightly sort of critical. But we need to look at this in a different way. Buddhism isn't a grim and dour path, you know, where pain is more real than pleasure, where we should sort of despise happiness and beauty as being somehow a way of avoiding the truth. It's very interesting. There's that incredible event before the Buddha's enlightenment where he's doing that fearsome asceticism, 6 years of starvation and really, you know, putting himself through it. And he has that realization that it's not working. And what isn't always, you know, understood there, he doesn't just take solid food. He doesn't just eat to look after his body. There's this very important realization that one of the things that he's been doing is rejecting pleasure, happiness that arises from skillful mental states. He's got this idea that all happiness, even the happiness generated by skillful states, even the happiness generated through meditation is somehow suspect, is somehow a snare. And he realizes it isn't. He has this memory of an early experience when he entered dhyana through contemplating, actually, his father ploughing a field and contemplating the suffering in that scene. And he thought, well, there were skillful states present there. There was spiritual purpose there and pleasure. And it wasn't a snare. It wasn't holding me down. So he recalls that experience of dhyana, skillfully generated happiness, goes back to it. But he goes through each of the higher meditative experiences, but he doesn't cling to anyone. He doesn't get intoxicated by anyone. So you get this wonderful vision of him sort of spiraling through these higher states, eventually onto enlightenment. I think it's an incredibly important passage. Happiness, pleasure generated by skillful states is incredibly important. It's as important as food and drink is to the physical body. It's the food and drink, to use a non-Buddhist word, of the soul, of the mind, of the heart. We need that experience of higher, if you like, pleasure and happiness, and indeed beauty. The higher meditative states are states of pure beauty, pure love, if you like. We need those things. They're really important because they represent the transformation of feeling and emotion. And without feeling and emotion, the transformation of feeling and emotion, spiritual life is, well, it's virtually impossible. So spiritual life means refining the sources of pleasure, re-educating, if you like, the senses. It's why the arts are so important, why the appreciation of nature is so important, why things like spiritual friendship are so important. All these have a central role to play in our spiritual practice. Not as an escape from reality. You know, when we're talking about the arts and so on, we're not talking about a sort of dilettante pursuit, but as a way of exploring reality, a way of exploring the truth. The truth enters the heart very powerfully because it comes with beauty. It comes as beauty. If you like, the beauty kind of, as it were, opens you up so the truth can come into you. So central to Buddhist practice is refining, expanding and intensifying consciousness. In a way, you could say, central to spiritual life is becoming a god, becoming a deva, but not a god of the wheel, not a god of the round. There's another kind of god recognized in Buddhist tradition, a god of the path, a deva on the path to enlightenment. The Buddha himself had disciples from among the gods. So a god of the path is one who, at the centre of their refined, intensified, expanded consciousness, is an orientation to the abiding truths of impermanence and change, an orientation towards an awareness of sickness, old age and death, an orientation towards enlightenment. Your consciousness is expanded enough, positive enough, refined enough to take all that in. That's why it's really important in meditation to dwell in more concentrated, more expansive states of mind. Then you can take the truth in. So I spoke there of expanded consciousness. The God realms represent an expansion of consciousness. There's less separation between self and other. Earlier I said that in the God realm there's no sexual differentiation. You've transcended all that. You're androgynous, so whatever that might mean. So there's no tension, no strain. In the God realms, apparently you sort of mingle with other gods. So the God realm is, if you like, a state of perfect friendship and harmony. It does sound, I know, very strange talking like this, and it can be, I think, misunderstood. But this is, in fact, what happens in meditation or even intense aesthetic experience or in very, very deep communication, sort of more selfless communication with other people. You, in a way, are not there anymore. Self and other, subject and object, have sort of blended and merged to some degree. And of course, this is intensely pleasurable as well as intensely transformative. So the God realm is a realm of harmony, and a realm of great sort of strength, if you like, of consciousness. The gods in the Indian tradition aren't sort of feeble and weedy. They're very sort of strong, intense figures. And this sort of idea is recognised as well in the Western angelic tradition, even in the Christian tradition. Again, by angel, I don't mean, as somebody once described them, weeds with wings, as they can sometimes be depicted. But the angels in the best angelic tradition are very dramatic, powerful figures indeed. And I want to mention a remarkable passage from Milton's Paradise Lost. You know, it is Christmas Eve after all. So let's do a little bit of transformation of our Christian tradition. The scene is Adam in the Garden of Eden before the fall. And Adam is talking with Raphael. Raphael has been sent down, and he's an incredibly beautiful figure, this powerful archangel with the most extraordinary exotic plumage, and he's described as the sociable spirit. He's particularly friendly, and Raphael's come down to talk with Adam about the mysteries of heaven and earth and hell and the celestial motions. And at a certain point, Adam asks about love. He asks Raphael about love, because Adam says he's so happy because of his love of Eve, their love for each other, their companionship. And by love, he definitely includes sexual love, because this is before the fall and sex is fine. It's the expression of, and this is Milton's view, that prelapsarian sexuality is great, it's fine, God given. So he's very happy with all that, the sort of totality of love. So he wants to know, because he's getting quite close to Raphael, if angels love. Do you, he says, love like that in the fullest sense? How do you do that love, he asks. Milton's poetry is much more refined than the way I'm telling it. How do they express that love? Is it just through looks, or is it through touch, or do you mix in some way? So I'm going to try and read from Paradise Lost Raphael's reply. Difficult to read, but I'll try. To whom the angel, with a smile that glowed celestial rosy red, love's proper hue, answered, "Let it suffice that thou knowest us happy, and without love no happiness. Whatever pure thou in the body enjoyest, and pure thou wert created, we enjoy in eminence, and obstacle find none of membrane, joint, or limb exclusive bars, easier than air with air, if spirits embrace, total they mix, union of pure with pure desiring, nor restrained conveyance need, as flesh to mix with flesh, or soul with soul." So even in this old Western tradition, the angelic realm, the God realm, is a realm of pure love, you could say, easily expressed and received, easier than air with air. Total they mix, union of pure with pure. So even in this Western tradition, there's this incredible vision of this angelic realm. And we know that for an earlier figure, the medieval figure Alred of Revo, the angelic realm is a realm of spiritual friendship. He takes the angelic realm as a kind of inspiration for spiritual friendship and spiritual community. And this does relate to Buddhist practice. There's another set of higher states of consciousness known as the Brahma Viharas, the abiding in Brahma, the abiding with Brahma, or the, if you like, the sublime abodes. And these are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And they're higher meditative states, God-like states, if you like. And it's understood they're not just meditative states, you express them, you live them as a life of friendliness and friendship within spiritual community, with others living like that. And when you live from the Brahma Viharas, when you live the Brahma Viharas, total they mix, union of pure with pure, will take place. We even find the Buddha talking about the Sangha in this way in the Dhammapada. Happy indeed we live. Feeders on rapture will we be, like gods of radiant light. So, friends like this are incredibly important. Creating a community like this is incredibly important, because within this sort of atmosphere, one has the perfect environment for seeing the truth. But only if we keep in mind impermanence and change and our ultimate spiritual goal, enlightenment for all beings. So we need to listen to the lute of impermanence when we're in these higher exalted states. Make sure that we're not just, as it were, taking flight, but we've also got our feet on the ground, if you can relate to that sort of paradox. Otherwise, we end up with a rather weird unreality if we fly off too easily into the Devalokas, and I'm only too conscious of that. I'm reminded of a scene in that great kind of cult film Zardoz by John Borman. That's a tremendous film about the Wheel of Life. If you ever want to see a movie about the Wheel of Life, see Zardoz. And there's this incredible scene where these immortals, these beautiful people, have decided, they're standing in a circle, and one of them saying, "We are now going to meditation level number 5. And they all start going into this kind of weird mystical state. And one of them, I don't know what the actor's name is. No, John Alderton, that's right. He used to be in Please, Sir. Those of you who remember that. He's saying, "No, I'm not going. I'm not going to meditation level number 5. Because he wants reality. He doesn't want to get caught up in this unreality. Anyway. So this brings me to the last of the 6 realms, the human realm, the realm we know best, the realm we know best of all, which we inhabit most of the time. For on the 3rd day of the Bardo, the purified element earth shines forth as a rich yellow light, and it shines from the southern direction, from the Buddha field called the Glorious. And in the midst of that rich yellow light, there is the transcendent Lord Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born, holding his consort Mamaki, and holding out to us a glowing jewel. He's seated on a throne of horses, and from his heart rich yellow light streams forth, brilliant and dazzling, adorned by larger and small drops of light. So there's a sort of a ray of yellow light coming towards you, towards your heart. And this rich yellow light is the light of the wisdom of sameness, samatha jnana. And at the same time, a dull blue light emanates from the human realm. It's very attractive, very comforting. The rich yellow light is too much, so we're attracted to that dull blue light, attracted to it under the pressure of the habit of the mental poison of pride, of conceit. Again, the Lama urges us to respond to the wisdom light, urges us to not respond to the dull blue light, because if we do, we'll be reborn in the human realm and we'll undergo yet again the sufferings of birth, of old age, of sickness and of death. And there'll be no immediate possibility of liberation from those sufferings, which would be possible if we respond to the brilliant yellow light of Ratnasambhava's wisdom of sameness. So conceit, pride, is another way that we try to deal with space. It's another way we try to deal with the breakup of the conditioned and the reality that can start to break through. We usually think, of course, of pride of conceit as arrogance, as of thinking of ourselves as superior to others, as of looking down on others. And if we think about it, we can see why pride would be the particular poison of the human realm. Human beings, because of their self-consciousness, their self-awareness, have found highly effective ways of surviving, of manipulating and dominating the world around them, animals, nature. And there's a deep-seated pride and conceit that runs alongside that. But the Buddhist analysis of pride, of conceit, the word is mana in Sanskrit, is more subtle than looking at things in terms of superiority. There are three kinds of conceit. First of all, there's conceit that is the view that one is superior to others. Secondly, the view that one is inferior to others. And thirdly, the view that one is equal to others. All these are forms of conceit. These three, all forms of conceit, of pride. Any view that fixes ourselves in relation to others, any positioning of the self, any form of egotism is conceit. Very challenging, this teaching. So looking at things in this way, we can see what can happen in the experience of bardo, in any bardo. The ground goes, the sand shift. One loses ground, loses a sense of self. At that moment, in that empty open moment, when the luminosity can arise, when a lucid clarity can arise, we kind of panic and we quickly re-establish who we are, our precise standing. We bring in a view about ourselves and where we stand and how we stand. We might experience this through the effects of meditation. Maybe there we are, meditating or after a meditation, and suddenly there are overwhelming feelings of loving kindness, of metta, flowing through you. You feel your self dissolving as the metta seems to flow through you. This all-pervading love kind of floating through you. It's blissful and pleasurable. But then, ever so subtly at first, because of previous habits, you start to kind of look at yourself, side on. I wonder if this is the arising of the bodhicitta. I wonder if I'm a bodhisattva. And of course, the background kind of script to that, I'm special and I can tell other people how special I am and what a wonderful meditation I had and what a fantastic retreat I had. You're establishing a view, a position. And before you know it, the opening of the heart, the flowing of love, has just closed down, has vanished. There's contraction and imprisonment. You're moored again to the pillar of a view about yourself. So this conceit of whatever kind is very deep-rooted, and it will emerge time and again. So don't be surprised or shocked by it. I mean, don't be surprised or shocked by any of this. Don't be surprised at its constant reassertion. It's only uprooted to seeing through the fiction of a fixed and separate selfhood. And along with the view of our superiority goes things like vanity, thinking that we're special. We are that special boy, that special person. Of course, we'd never admit to it, unlike Chelsea's manager, Jose Mourinho. I'm the special one, he says. He did have the good grace to say recently that Pele was the real special one, but I digress. At least you know where you stand with Jose Mourinho. So we can think that we're a special spiritual person, or maybe that we might be a special spiritual person. And that we're really kind of outstanding, we're so special. And when we lose interest in meditation, because it's difficult, and the spiritual life, and we take up something else, well, that's because we're special. We're on a deep path, really. We're exploring reality in our special way. And of course, the fact is we're just conceited and arrogant and vain and narcissistic. D.H. Lawrence, in one of his acid observations of the people of his time, has a poem called Ultimate Reality. When I saw it in the index, I thought, oh, this sounds good. Ultimate Reality. A young man said to me, I am interested in the problem of reality. I said, really? Then I saw him glance again, surreptitiously, in the big mirror, at his own fascinating shadow. Really great poem. So we're often doing that, aren't we? Kind of looking surreptitiously, or not so surreptitiously, at our own fascinating shadow. So So one of the things that the Dharma does, if you really stay with it, if you really stick with it, and if you're really involved in a spiritual community with other people practicing, if you're involved in it year after year, you learn that you're not that special, actually. You're not special at all. And you learn this the hard way, through continuous humiliations, through the circumstances of life. Your vanity, your conceit, your pride is just brought low. Again, this is a big theme in Tibetan Buddhism, in Tantric Buddhism. The brilliant, proud disciple who's constantly trying to impress his teacher, coming along, talking about his experiences, trying out psychic powers, all this sort of thing. And the teacher is just sort of deeply unimpressed, bored at the floor show, completely bored. I mean, one of the things we used to say about Bhante, about Sangharakshita, was, you know, when you go to see him and he'd kind of look out the window and would be yawning. It's very disconcerting. Did it only happen to me? I hope not. Nobody's special. Nobody's special. None of us are special. Even the most fantastic person, you know, in the world isn't special. Maybe we're all unique. You know, we're all got our own, you know, particular individual kind of qualities and quirks, but nobody's special. I mean, just look at it in terms of Buddha nature. It's one of those teachings that people love to get hold of. It's curious, this Buddha nature stuff. People can often get very, very hoity-toity about it, very arrogant about it. But, you know, the Buddha gave the teaching on Buddha nature because he said, well, everybody's got it. There's nothing special about you bodhisattvas. You know, don't think that you're high and mighty. Everybody's got it. So don't make distinctions. There's nothing special about you. Probably you're thinking, well, I'm not one of these vain types. And perhaps for most people, this conceit doesn't apply. Perhaps a more pervasive form of conceit is the view that one is inferior. Inferior to others, or just plain inferior. Uniquely flawed. A kind of hopeless case. You know, a case where, other the truths don't apply. And Surat is always teasing me about this. I'd done a bit of exercise and it improved some discomfort I'd had in my back. And he was saying, so there you are, actions have consequences. I said, no, I don't think it was that. He said, so you're special, are you? It doesn't apply to you, this particular truth, that actions have consequences. No, of course not. I've got special problems. Anyway. Yes, we can start thinking on the retreat, maybe. Well, I'm the sort of weak link on the retreat. I've got those sort of unique, special problems. So, I'm the uniquely bad person. And, of course, what results from this is that we start feeling we haven't anything to contribute to others, that we can't practice the Dharma, that we can't make a contribution to life, and so on. But this is conceit. It's a view. It's a fixing of ourselves. So we miss, because of that, the creative eruptions, the bright light of the Buddha in the Bardo. We refuse it. The refusal is a pride. And I've met people, I've known people like this. Like I say, you can see it easier in other people. People in very real difficulties, in really painful states. And you've seen, you know that they're not completely defined by that, by this intense negativity and pain. You know that. You've seen the other side. You spend time, you listen, you remind them of their other side, and they just block you out. They just close you down, and you feel you're up against this incredible sort of rigidity and arrogance and conceit, even though they're in hell. Well, as the Tibetans say, you can even make hell comfortable. So the view that we're uniquely flawed, a great sinner, the greatest sinner, is another way of avoiding space, avoiding the flow, avoiding the openness of existence. Remember, you know, this is often brought up in Buddhist texts. You know, they like to quote the sutras, you know, when people are feeling downhearted. Well, remember what the Buddha said, that even worms have Buddha nature. You know, and of course people go off and start looking at worms to find it. But I take this as a sort of metaphor, you know, that, you know, sometimes we sort of feel like a worm, don't we? Well, that's okay. It's fine that you feel like a worm. Let's not dispute that. But you have Buddha nature. So when you're feeling a bit sort of wormy, it's okay, you've got Buddha nature. You're not uniquely sort of fallen. But we must also watch out for the view, the conceit, that we're equal to others. Sometimes we deal with the open space by pretending that we're all equal. We're all on the same level. We try to sort of level everything out, everybody out, so there's no movement, there can be no emergence. You find sometimes people very keen to insist that we're all equal, all the same. Sometimes I found that in groups sometimes, as somebody keeps going on that we're all equal. And I always think, I wonder why they're saying that. I wonder what's going on here. How do we know? How do we know? How do we know that in this room there aren't people who are completely outstanding, head and shoulders beyond us, more ethical, more intelligent, more loving, more worthy? You know, how do we know that? How do we know that there aren't some incredibly outstanding people in this room that we could really learn from? The view of everyone being equal can close down possibilities for everyone. Again, we're kind of frightened of losing our ground. It's not surprising that conceit and pride should be the particular poison associated with the human realm. In the human realm, self-consciousness, reflexive consciousness has emerged. We're aware that we're aware. We're not simply aware of sense impressions. We can reflect on our experience. We can stand back from our experience. We have a sense of continuity, of history. We can reflect on our history, on our life. We can stand back from what's happening and learn from it. We can reason, we can think, we can imagine. And it's a wonderful gift, this. It's so special, but it's a double-edged sword. It's the key to liberation, but it's also the key to terrible imprisonment. In the human realm, we have the possibility of developing this reflexive awareness to the fullest extent, even transcending this reflexive awareness by developing the Buddha's awareness. In the human realm, we're not overwhelmed by the poisons or by pleasure or pain. The human realm is a mixture. There's just enough suffering and just enough pleasure and an awareness that can be cultivated. This is why in the human realm, compassion manifests as the golden yellow Buddha Shakyamuni, holding a monk's staff and begging bowl, the insignia of the spiritual life. Because in the human realm, when we've attained the human realm, the next thing to do is to follow the spiritual life. To go for refuge, as it's called traditionally, to the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha, the three jewels. And Ratnasambhava gives the three jewels. We can develop and cultivate our humanity to the fullest extent. Instead of conceit of any kind, we develop Ratnasambhava's wisdom of sameness. We see the same reality in all things, pervading all life, the same impermanence, the same insubstantiality everywhere, the same Buddha nature in all beings. We realise our essential sameness, realise the essential sameness of ourselves and others. Yes, we are gloriously distinct and unique, but we're essentially the same. The same life flows through us as flows through others. We have the same longing for happiness, the same desire for safety, and to be free from pain as others do. In this way, we can identify with everyone, with everything, cultivate the same love, the same metta, the same golden yellow loving kindness for all beings. And never feel apart from the deep, the mysterious interconnectedness of all life. And in the human realm, we know all about life and sickness and death. We know the fragility of it all. We know we can remind ourselves that life is short, its duration uncertain. We know that we must make the most of this precious human life, which is, of course, where I came in just a few days ago.